Just to provide a little bit of background on pandemic flu, a pandemic occurs when a new strain of flu emerges that is new, so everyone in the community is susceptible to it, and this strain is capable of rapid human-to-human transmission. When experts talk about pandemic flu, they use words like imminent and inevitable. So it's really not a question of if, but when. And the reason that we think that a pandemic is fairly inevitable is because, first of all, it occurs on a cyclical nature about once every 30 years. So there's a sense that we're due for one. Also, we're particularly concerned about H5N1, which is a highly virulent strain of flu that has been circulating in avian populations. It emerged in Hong Kong in 1997, and we see a very high case fatality rate in human cases. There have been a little over 300 cases and a little over 200 deaths, so this is a very frightening strain. So to react to this, there's been planning at various levels and sectors of the government. Corporations have been encouraged to plan for pandemic flu, local governments, state governments, hospitals, both government entities and non-government entities. And we're particularly interested in college and university planning. In March 2006, the CDC came out with formal guidelines for colleges and universities to begin the process of planning for pandemic influenza. Now, there are about 4,000 institutions of higher learning in the U.S., and we believe that colleges and universities will be impacted both as individual institutions, and they are impacted because they have a role in the wider community. In terms of being impacted as individual institutions, first of all, you usually see a U-shaped mortality curve in a pandemic, and that means that you see deaths among the very young and the very old. But in certain pandemics like 1918, which was the most severe of the century, you actually see a W-shaped mortality curve, which means that you see quite a few deaths among young adults and adolescents. And this is because they have a very strong immune response to the flu, which actually ends up killing them. So we have a population that is going to be highly affected by a virulent strain of flu. Also, there are major consequences for research, and we saw this in Hurricane Katrina. When a campus is evacuated, that's going to have implications for laboratory research, all different types of research. Then again, colleges and universities also have a role in the wider community because they're sites of transmission. Really what happens in colleges and universities is people are in communal living quarters, they're eating in communal facilities, there's often poor hygiene and sharing of personal items, so there's really the potential for flu to spread rapidly in these populations. And in 1918, we saw flu spreading rapidly in military, in the trenches, in these same kind of situations where there was congregations of people. Now, one of the major measures that's advocated for containing the flu is school closure, and that's a primary social distancing measure or a non-pharmaceutical intervention. It's been used for a long time. For example, it was the primary measure used in 1918 that was a non-pharmaceutical measure. It's endorsed by the U.S. Plan for Pandemic Influenza and also by the Institute of Medicine. And although we really feel that we're going to rely on this to stop the spread of pandemic flu, all the data that exists so far comes from closure of elementary and secondary schools. There have been modeling studies, studies of what's happened in the past, and really it's looking at that population because we're really concerned that children will incubate the virus and be one of the major spreaders. So despite what I've said about the roles of universities and colleges, there's no literature on college planning or the impact of closure or, you know, any modeling studies that discuss this technique of, you know, closing down a university and how that might affect pandemic spread. So to deal with this gap, our objective was to assess the current state of college and university planning for flu and to inform guidance for these institutions. We performed in-depth interviews with pandemic planners at 13 colleges and universities in Philadelphia. There are a total of 14, so we got a very high participation rate. And we produced an interview guide that was based on published influenza plans that we found on the internet and also on the CDC guidance checklist that I mentioned that came out in March 2006. This provides a little bit of background on the demographic characteristics of the schools that we surveyed. As you can see, we really had schools in a variety of categories, mostly private, but we had a wide range of sizes and It's interesting that most schools had a student health office, and in many cases, the student health office was taking the lead in planning for pandemic flu. This provides a snapshot of our results, and what's most striking from this slide is that slightly less than half reported having a written pandemic plan, and only 1/4 of the smaller schools. So we surveyed 8 schools with fewer than 4,000, and then the others who had more than 4,000 students. So we do believe that there are major barriers to planning specifically for pandemic flu. A little bit more positively, many of the schools were engaged in some type of all-hazards emergency planning, and many of the schools reported having adequate facilities for isolation and quarantine. Many of them had not planned for isolation and quarantine, but they did have the facilities, so the capabilities, we believe, are there. We found out that there were numerous barriers to planning. First of all, schools reported a lack of information resources. Most of them used federal guidance, like the CDC checklist that I mentioned, and also materials that were reported at state conferences and local conferences. One interesting thing was that we found that 1/4 of the schools were actually using a template plan that was presented at a presentation that they went to. And this was the plan from Carnegie Mellon University, and they were circulating that amongst themselves and using that as a template to guide their planning efforts. Other barriers included lack of financial resources, meaning that the school was not budgeting for these activities, and also a lack of political will, the issue of planning for a hypothetical threat, you know, among a myriad of everyday threats. So despite the barriers, we did find certain promising practices that we wanted to share to schools engaged in these type of activities. First of all, one school had created a buddy system. They sent out a letter to parents suggesting that all students that lived out of area find a buddy or a roommate who lived within the state, and that person would be the person that they would go home with in case of an emergency. And what we really like about the buddy system is that it is an example of an all-hazards approach. It will work for pandemic flu, it will work for hurricane, you know, really any emergency that emerges. So, you know, it's widely applicable. Another promising practice was planning for different scenarios. Some schools really did recognize that a pandemic can really appear in a variety of shapes and sizes. So, you know, one school planned for a scenario in which all the students are on campus because there's no warning. Another school planned for that. Well, sorry, that same school also planned for a scenario in which there was plenty of warning and they managed to evacuate most of the campus beforehand. So they were really looking at this from several different perspectives. At the Philadelphia Health Department, we constructed an example of a matrix that you could use to plan for different scenarios. And this matrix combines two different approaches. There's an approach based on where the pandemic is geographically and also the severity of the pandemic. The CDC Severity Index appeared in the Community Mitigation Strategy document that came out earlier this year, and it really takes the same approach as when you measure a hurricane, meaning that a Category 5 is very strong, there's a high case fatality rate, very severe pandemic. So if schools want to plan, they can, you know, look at a pandemic as it might be defined in these various categories. Our study has several limitations. First of all, there's always the issue of external validity. We only looked at schools in Philadelphia. That's a good picture. Right, we only looked at schools in Philadelphia, and we're unsure how well we can generalize to other schools in the region or to the country. We do feel, however, that we did get schools in a variety of categories, variety of sizes, and the guidance materials that have been circulating are likely to be the same everywhere. And, you know, the federal guidance is all the same. So we believe that, you know, this is probably fairly generalizable. Another thing is, this is just a snapshot of planning efforts. Planning is a dynamic process. The results here are only valid for a certain period of time. And then also there's the issue of participant biases. There's something called social desirability bias in which people are trying to present their institution in the most favorable light. And some people were worried about the PR implications if it was announced that they weren't planning for an emergency appropriately. So I think there was some concern in speaking with me about that. Several recommendations come out of this research. First of all, for schools, we hope that they plan for variation in pandemic impact and follow things like the scheme that we showed you. In most cases, there was just one assumption going through the entire plan. For example, it's going to be like 1918, catastrophic, or it's going to be fairly mild, and, you know, we won't need to close schools. Another thing is we're hoping schools will integrate all hazards best practices. There's the problem of planning fatigue, and if we plan for one scenario, you know, one disaster type, and it doesn't happen, smaller schools especially are not going to have the resources to keep doing this, so it's much better if they pick up practices that are broadly applicable. For public health agencies, we're hoping they will provide concrete examples of planning and perhaps create something like a peer review system. We were a little bit alarmed about the news of the schools using One Common Plan as a template. Not speaking to the merits of that plan, it's just that it wasn't officially endorsed by anyone. It would be great if there was a website that had expert commentary on the pros and cons of various decisions that were made in that plan, or, you know, the government could officially endorse a certain plan, just more guidance from local governments on the quality of what's being circulated. Also, we really need to expand the checklist model. Right now, guidance for emergencies comes in the form of checklists, meaning, you know, there's a task and the school then decides whether that task is completed or in progress or hasn't been started yet. And the problem with that is it doesn't really provide any guidance onto the level of appropriate detail in planning. So a school might think they have addressed the issue of isolation and quarantine, but what does that really mean? I mean, have they identified buildings, rooms? How specific do you really need to get? Also, public health agencies need to coordinate planning across institutions. Smaller schools express an interest in working together, but they really weren't communicating at the point of our survey. More guidance on triggers and stockpiling. Those were two areas that schools felt were pretty ambiguous. Also, health departments need to address the expectations of schools. Many schools felt that the local government would be providing antivirals. The local government needs to know what those expectations are, and those expectations should be reflected in their own planning efforts. And finally, guidance should differentiate between large and small institutions. A lot of smaller institutions felt that the guidance wasn't really curbed for their needs, and they felt that it wasn't applicable. And because of that, they felt that that sort of removed the obligation to plan. You know, this doesn't speak to me or my needs. And that's a problem. We need to really have guidance that reflects everyone's needs. So the areas for further research to come up are, we're interested in perhaps coming up with a standard pandemic planning skill set. We found that a variety of different roles in the institution were taking over pandemic flu planning efforts. For example, it could be someone in student health, it could be someone in an academic office. What do you really need to be the pandemic planner for your institution? Do you need to understand basic disease epidemiology? Do you need to understand NIMS, incident command, that kind of thing? Also, we need to do more research on the barriers to planning, because as we saw, there are serious barriers, and only once we understand those are we going to be able to take steps to overcome them. So that's all for today. Thank you very much.